You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Dog-Eared Radio Book Club. I'm your host, Randy. Dog-Eared Radio Book Club is a radio show about books that comes to you every 2 weeks where we read a book and talk about it, or maybe just talk about a whole genre. You never know. You can always reach me with book suggestions, feedback on episodes, anything like that at dog-eared book club radio@gmail.com, or you can find me on Instagram at Dog-Eared Radio Book Club. So we have a spectacular episode planned for you today, a very chunky episode filled with a lot of content, and I have two guests. I have two guests on my show today to tackle this book with me, so I want to go ahead and introduce the guests before we get into the book. So the first guest I want to introduce is Malika. Malika is returning to the show, one of my very good friends and fellow book lover. Welcome to the show again.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. You know I love coming on the show.
I know you do, and I love that you love it. Okay, and my second guest is also a returning guest to the show, and one of the first Bookstagrammers that I had on the show, which is very exciting for me. So, Sunny, welcome back to the show, and how are you doing today?
Hi, Randy. Thanks so much for having me back. It's such a pleasure to be able to chat with you and meet Malika on this show. So, yeah, I'm excited to be back.
Same. It's nice to meet you too.
Yes, we're all meeting with our voices today, which will be very good. We did meet, full disclosure for listeners, we did meet to plan this episode before, because I'm not going to go headfirst into an episode like this just without any planning. So for today's episode, we are talking about the 544-page novel by R.F. Kuang called Babel, An Arcane History. So Rebecca Kuang is a award-winning author known for The Poppy Wars, Yellowface, and the book we're talking today, Babel. She has a Master's of Philosophy in Chinese Studies from Cambridge, and also a Master's of, I believe it's Science in Contemporary Chinese Studies from Oxford. And she's also now pursuing a PhD in East Asian Languages and Literatures at Yale. So we all got the chance to see her speak when she was in Vancouver on her press for Yellowface, at a book signing and a talk. So I know that we're all very excited to talk about this work. I know that both of my guests have read more than just Babel by Rebecca, so I have not had that privilege yet, but I'm still so excited to talk about this book. So yeah, and I will just say right off the bat that there will be full spoilers for this episode. We are going to spoil the entire book. So if you haven't read it, just keep that in mind. As always, we post our episodes later, so if you don't want me to spoil Babel for you right now, just go ahead, maybe change the radio station, turn off this podcast, pause it, go pick it up, spend a casual several hours reading it, and then come back and listen to it. Okay, so when I first came with this episode to Sunny and Malika, who I know I want to talk about this book with, I knew that we had to split it up. I knew that it had to be more than one episode. There's no way that we could cover this book in one episode. I couldn't see it happening. So when I put forth kind of how we should split it up, Malika suggested in the first episode we tackle the magic system and the plot, and then in the second episode, which will come out 2 weeks from when this episode comes out, we'll be talking more about the characters, a bit more about like the social impact of the book, social media around the book, all of our favorite TikTok reactions to this book that we love to talk about. But yeah, in the meantime, we're going to be talking about the plot in the beginning of this episode. So I'm gonna first give the briefest overview by doing my favorite activity that I do on the show, where I read the description of the book and then we chat about how accurate or good it is. Okay, so here we go. Once again, as always, I have not practiced this, so it'll be fun. 1828, Robin Swift, orphaned by cholera in Canton, is brought to London by the mysterious Professor Lovin. There, he trains for years in Latin, ancient Greek, and Chinese, all in preparation for the day he'll enroll in Oxford University's prestigious Royal Institute of Translation, also known as Babel. The Tower and its students are the world center for translation and, more importantly, magic. Silverworking, the art of manifesting the meaning lost in translation using enchanted silver bars, has made the British unparalleled in power, as the arcane craft serves the empire's quest for colonization. For Robin, Oxford is a utopia dedicated to the pursuit of knowledge. But knowledge obeys power, and as a Chinese boy raised in Britain, Robin realizes serving Babel means betraying his motherland. As his studies progress, Robin finds himself caught between Babel and the Shadowy Hermes Society, an organization dedicated to stopping imperial expansion. When Britain pursues an unjust war with China over silver and opium, Robin Swift must decide. Can powerful institutions be changed from within, or does revolution always require violence? Okay, so as always, my question is, does this description suit the book that we read? So I'm going to go ahead and ask Sunny what you think of to start us off.
I think it's a fun teaser, in my opinion. It's because it gives you the opening, but not really the full picture of what's going to happen. During Robin's time at Babel, not Babel, it is the Oxford University's Royal Institute of Translation. So it feels a bit like a teaser to get you enticed and drawn into this like mystery of like, who is Professor Lovell and like what is going to happen to Robin while he's there.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Malika, do you want to add your view of how well the description that I read suits the book?
I agree with Sunny. It's just very much, it's an introduction. Like, it gives you a little bit tidbit of like what you're going to get into. Like, I think it just sets up the beginning. Like, it's, the book is split up into different books. I think it's basically the summary for book one of like, or part one.
Yeah, I think that it offers, as you said, Sunny, a good intro into what is to come. I think it's interesting just looking back, and we'll get more into this when we talk about the plot. I really wasn't prepared for what happened in this novel. Not so much like I need to be prepared, but just that, you know, it is such a dense novel that it offers a lot of opportunities to surprise the reader. And, you know, the ending, as I was reading this novel, I kept thinking in the back of my head, like, how is this going to unfold? And then I was kind of like, oh, I wasn't expecting that. But then now that I've like finished it, it sort of leaves me with this feeling of like, I wasn't expecting it, but I didn't know how else it would be done. So it sort of just makes sense now, which I think is quite interesting. Okay, well, thank you for sharing your thoughts. So without further ado, we are going to get into the plot. So I thought a lot about how to go through this because obviously this book is over 500 pages long. So for me to condense the plot and then offer time to talk about it is quite a task. So I wanted to start with like just some general points. This is where all the spoilers once again will come into play. We're going to be talking about the whole plot. So the first thing I want to kind of like break down and talk about is Babel. So Babel is the tower. So physically it's at kind of the center of Oxford. I think it's a 7-story tower. And it's home to this very prestigious language program. And home to the best translators, the best professors of language, you know, in the white Western British Empire. So as far as the levels go, you have the lobby at the bottom, and then you have legal, interpretation, literature, reference materials, instruction rooms, and faculty office, and silver working. So it's actually 8. I lied. It's not 7. And so this offers the setting for the majority of the novel. A lot of the novel takes place in this tower. And silver working is, as I said, on the very top. That's the magic element of this novel. We're going to get into that more in the second half of this episode. But yeah, I think that that's like kind of the basis. But I'm curious, Malika and Sunny, if you have anything to like offer as far as like understanding Babel as like a structure, but also like part of the novel. Just want to open it up in case you have anything to share. So we'll go ahead and start with Malika, if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, I just thought, like, when we think of, like, the university life, we think of grandness and lushness, and that's kind of what the tower represents. It's not kind of, it is what the tower represents. It represents this life that these students have access to that seems unattainable. All these kids are from different countries they're pulled from, and I don't know if I can say, I'm allowed to spoil, right? So,
yes, you can.
Okay. They all have to dream in their language to be able to get the magic to work. So I just think that's so interesting, considering that this tower is also like a dream of theirs. And it's just like, I really liked how Kwong, I dealt with the idea of dreaming in this novel, like how, okay, there's the Babel, which is like the tower, the Oxford dream. And then there's also dreaming of the motherland, dreaming in your own mother tongue and stuff. So I think it's just the ideology surrounding the tower as a place and like its significance in the novel. I don't know. It really stands out for me. I really enjoy that piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really agree with that. I like how, yeah, you pointed out that it's like a symbol, but it also has like this very real impact on the characters in the story. Sunny, do you have any thoughts to add?
I was really excited by the title alone because I'm just speculating, but there are like two things that I think she could have based the Tower of Babel off of. And one is the short story by, I am going to butcher his name, I think it's Jorge Luis Borges. I'm probably saying it wrong, but there's a short story called The Library of Babel, and it's like this infinite library of infinite knowledge, which is a really cool like, classic short story if you ever want to read it. And then I wonder if like that spun off of also there's like a biblical story called, I don't know what the story is called. There's a biblical story where in this Tower of Babel, what happens? These people like start building this tower towards the heavens and God gets angry. So he splits them apart by basically like giving them different languages. So these people like initially all spoke the same language, but then like after he like stops them from building this like tower, like he like creates new languages. And it's kind of like an origin story for different languages. And I think like a lot of her like references, like what she wrote, alludes to that, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't think I knew of either of those. I'm trying to rack my brain if I'd heard of that short story before. I mean, that's kind of what this Babel is. Like, it does contain, like, in their minds, kind of this infinite amount of knowledge through language.
Yeah, and sorry, I do know the biblical story, so it was just interesting. I forgot about it. Thank you, Sunny, for reminding me. But it's, like, I thought it was interesting considering that it's about colonization when the story originally was about like separating everything, like the languages in pieces and stuff. Cause there's another book, it's a YA book, The Gilded Wolves. That's also kind of about the Tower of Babel and all the allegories around that and how it was like separating peoples. I don't know. I just find that very interesting. Sorry. I don't know where I was going on that tangent.
No, there's no tangents. That's a really good, this is all good backstory that like obviously if you just read the novel you don't necessarily have. So this is the point of the show, right? To offer further context and thoughts. Sunny, when we met to talk about this novel, and what we're gonna talk about in the episode, one of the things that you said is that this is a very plot-driven novel. So I wanted for like why this stands out to you as a plot-driven novel, if there's anything specific in the plot that kind of like sticks with you.
Sure. I think for starters, this book just reads so much like an academic text, but put into a story. R.F. Kuang talks a lot, like it's a lot about academia, colonization, and like racism. And there's just all of these different dynamics that are, the way it's written is very intellectual. And I feel like the characters read a lot like chess pieces. I don't think the characters are like the most well-developed, and that's not necessarily a flaw to the book. I think the book focuses more on like bigger picture. So the characters feel more like representations of ideas, especially with Letty as like white feminism. Like it's, I feel like they're like chess pieces, and she uses them as plot points to drive her narrative in terms of her discussions on like more overarching themes of colonization. So I think in that sense, that's why I felt to me it was very much plot driven. And then I don't know, I haven't read any of Charles Dickens, but I did hear in some of her interviews, she mentions that she was very influenced by Charles Dickens. So if either of you have read Charles Dickens, maybe you could compare a bit more, but I haven't actually read anything by him, regrettably, but that might be, yeah, that would be an interesting thing to explore.
Yeah, thank you. I definitely, this is something, it was interesting because I wasn't done the novel when we initially met. And so I got to take kind of both of your thoughts in the back of my mind while I was finishing the novel. And I can definitely see the point about how like a lot of the character, they move and progress forward on these kind of overarching ideas that are like part of the novel. And one of the ways that I really saw that is like, I think there's so much to like be learned, not necessarily learned, but like understood or like to think about in this novel. And I think a lot of that happens like in these situations. So in like the confrontation where I mentioned that Robin ends up killing his father, in the conversations around like the institution that they constantly have at Babel between their cohort. And then I think especially we'll have to wait. I know that I'm absolutely dying to talk about this, and I know Malika is too, but we'll have to wait till we get to the character episode to talk about Letty, and kind of all the conversation and like quotes around that. But I want to open it up to you, Malika, to see if you have anything to add again to the plot, or yeah, like anything to add to the overview or how you kind of view the plot in this novel.
Yeah, no. So when I read it, I really enjoyed it because I really enjoyed the plot as sort of a way, like it's like Sunny said, it was read as a textbook, but I kind of feel like with more emotions, if that makes sense to anyone. Like that's definitely what I was feeling, like kind of like in me and Randy both did GRSJ, that was kind of like our like academic text. Like it would be very, very academia, like the jargon was very academic, but at the end there was heart and emotions, and that's kind of what drives, I feel like, social justice movements. So I really enjoyed that part of like the plot, where it was like, yes, it was very like, oh, we need to hit this point, this point, this point. But there was just so much heart to it. And that's what I think the necessity of violence comes in, that love and hate, love and violence come, like they're both very strong plot points in this novel. And I thought it was great. And something Sunny said to me when we met before this meeting, just to say, so I didn't read it as like the whole chess pieces as the characters. I was like fully like into them. I was like, oh my God, I also think I like projected a little bit onto Rami as a character because he's an Indian Muslim and I'm an Indian Muslim. And there's not many characters like that. Like they're either, if they're Muslim, they're from Pakistan, or if they're Indian, they're Hindu. So I don't know. It was just like, it was just really interesting rereading it. I didn't finish my reread, sadly, but rereading it with that in mind, viewing them as just chess pieces was just a very different take on it. So I thought that was interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. It's definitely, I mean, you can finish your reread in time for the next episode, because we got another one in 2 weeks. I don't know. I always find it interesting to talk to other people that read the same book that you read and like how you kind of gain from how they Reddit, right? There's a lot to be understood of like how everyone's mind works differently, the points that they pay attention to. Okay, so we're going to take a very quick break for the listeners. So don't go anywhere. When we get back, we're going to talk about the magic system so that we all understand. And then we're going to get into some nice, fantastic, fun little questions that are going to be super easy to answer. These are like short answer questions, I promise.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek coffee today.
Everyone at VAMS understands the challenges of having a disability in an able-bodied world. Since 1988, the Vancouver Adapted Music Society has supported musicians with disabilities on their journeys. Check out Reimagine Radio on YouTube to learn more about our diverse community. To stay up to date with us, subscribe to the channel and drop a like to show some support.
Are you looking for ways to be a part of the community through low-stakes opportunities like volunteering? What about making friends that are really cool or have some common interests? Well, I'm here to tell you that at CITR, you can come volunteer at Volunteer Wednesdays, happening every other Wednesday from 12 to 3 with a really fun activity each time, like making signs or button making. Not only is it a great break from outside stress, but a great opportunity to be a part of the community. For more information, you can visit CITR's Instagram page at CITR and Discorder.
All right, welcome listeners back to Dog Ear Radio Book Club. I'm your host, Randy. In today's episode, we are talking about the book Babel by R.F. Kuang. And I am joined today by two amazing guests. I'm joined by returning guest Sunny and returning guest Malika. So before the break, we spoiled every aspect about the plot of this book. And now we're going to talk about the magic system, which I've labeled the magic of it all. Malika, I'm going to be relying on you for this because you were the one who explained this magic system to me before I even read the novel, which is incredibly impressive, although I don't remember any of it. So in one of your many explanations of this novel, you did explain the magic system to me. So I'm hoping that you can sort of do that again for the listeners and just kind of add details that you think are relevant. And also if you want to like speak on kind of how, again, you view the magic in the plot of this novel.
Yeah, for sure. So I was just so intrigued by this magic system. Magic is my favorite. I love fantasy. I love everything to do with magic systems. So this one was really cool because I am a person who does not, unfortunately, speak my mother tongue. I barely spoke it as a kid and completely lost it when I moved away from a more densely populated Indian area, South Asian population area, to a more white area. So it was it was kind of sad reading it. I felt a lot of relatability to Griffin as a character because he doesn't dream in his own mother tongue. And that was one of the things that drove the magic system. So basically the match pairs work where it's one side, it will be the English word and the other side will be the rough translation, like the word in whatever language they were working in. So for Robin, it was Chinese and or Chinese, Latin and Greek, I believe were Robin's languages. I'm not too sure. And what the made the magic work was whatever's lost in translation. So one of the examples they gave in the book was, I forgot the other word, but it was like speed, like for the boat, and then they translate, and then on the other side it was the other language, and it's whatever could not be translated, lost in translation was the magic. And I actually have a really good example of what just of something like that that just happened in our life, like literally an hour ago. So I was trying to find the English word. So there's this word in Hindi called, it's like jatko, like it's kind of like brushing off the tablecloth, like you take it outside, or like a mat or anything, you take it outside and you, like, you know when you like flap it around and brush it, like, see, it's like so hard to explain what this action was, but I was trying to like explain it to my sister in English, like, oh, can you go do this to the tablecloth, and she's like, what? And I'm like juggle it, and she's like, okay, why didn't you just say that? And I was like, I don't know, I was trying to find the English word. So basically that not knowing, that understanding, that like trying to figure it out is the magic, the what causes these the silver working to work.
Oh. Okay, that's way more complicated than I thought.
Sorry, I can try to simple it down, but basically what's lost in translation powers the silver.
No, you did a fantastic job of explaining it. Absolutely, 100%. I'm just a little embarrassed that I don't think I picked up on the complexity of like when I read the novel.
Oh, yeah. I love that description. It was short, simple, and sweet, because I don't think I would have been able to explain that.
Yeah. Do you have anything to add about the magic system as far as how it, like, how you kind of view it in the novel, Sunny?
I don't think I have anything like particular to add. I just love the magic system. I feel like when I talk about things to like close friends, like oftentimes there will be a Chinese word in my head that comes up. And there's no direct English translation for it. And it stresses me out because like the English translation that I can think of usually doesn't capture the whole essence of the Chinese word. So I thought it was really cool to just see Arif Kuang like put it into a book as a magic system.
There was also just this sort of like melancholy about it too. Like as someone who like wants to like know their mother tongue and wants to be a native speaker, like it was just like, you really felt for Griffin as like he couldn't, like the way like he was disposable to Dr. Lovell, being like, oh, you don't dream in your native language. I think there was a line that Dr. Lovell actually says where it's like, I should have let you stay longer in the motherland so you could have dreamed, so the magic works more effectively. Because that's another piece of like the magic system, where it's like the more you if you can dream fluently in your mother tongue, then the magic is like pure, it works, it's not shaky or anything. So I don't know, there was just something really interesting about that. Like there's like, holy crap, like colonization took something away that we didn't even know was there. Like I really like made me reassess my relationship with Hindi and like Fiji Hindi and like all these different aspects of my life that I completely was like, I don't need to know either of them. I'm going to university in this white institution. I'm living in Canada. Like, I don't know. I just really enjoyed how Becca Kuang put something you didn't even realize was happening to you into words.
Yeah, it's so sad. I get it, because I'm also not that fluent in Chinese and Mandarin. Like, I was like you were. Growing up, you just felt like you didn't need to use it. And then when you get older, you realize you've lost that opportunity to pick it up fluently.
Yeah, and it gets sadder as the generations go on. Like, I at least know a little bit of Hindi. My sister, like, that's why I was trying to explain the jutko word earlier. She, like, just looked straight through me. She was like, I don't know what you're saying. And I'm like, oh my gosh. I was like, I thought I was a coconut. She's even worse.
Yeah, well, thank you both for sharing. I definitely feel like that offers like a lot of a much deeper understanding of the magic system, as opposed to just being like magic thrown in. Like, and I think kind of I agree with what you said, Sunny. Like, the magic system is one of the things that I love about this book. Just like everything else, it feels intentional. Like, it doesn't feel just like reading a fantasy novel and they tend to just like sometimes throw in like a random magic system that like doesn't really make any sense or just feels like super repetitive like any fantasy novel. So yeah, I feel like this feels like it feels very intentional, which I really enjoy. And I also think that it feels grounded. Something that I enjoyed about reading this book is that, and I think this kind of goes back to what you were saying, Malika, that this book, like, it's sort of, it's like a hybrid book in my head. So it's talking about a lot of very real issues and things. It's talking about colonization, it's talking about empire, it's talking about expansion, things like that. And at the same time, it brings in these aspects of this magic system, of sort of reimagining this like certain time period in history, but it still reads as like a very real experience, and a very real story that you're going through with the characters. So really good. Okay. Well, without further ado, I'd like to move forward to some questions that I've written. They're not grand and profound, because when I was writing the questions, I purposely didn't want to do that, because obviously there's like super open-ended questions you could ask with this novel, such as like, is violence necessary or not? Obviously I don't want us to have to go through like a PhD level dissertation on that for this episode, but the first question that I have is, where do you kind of see this book sitting in discussions that we have about colonialism and its legacy, but also ongoing colonization, ongoing imperialism? And yeah, it kind of goes back to what I was just saying about how, like, although this novel is like a fictional novel, and contains magic, it also is grounded in so many of these really real stories, specifically about the role that language plays. So yeah, sort of an open-ended question to get us started. But Sunny, if you want to kind of give us your thoughts on that.
Do you mind if I go into a deep dive on academic institutions?
I would love.
So I'm steering a little away from the language aspect, but this first question, the first thing that popped into my head made me think about Western academic institutions and colonization in modern day. And something that's really interesting about post-secondary institutions is when you're looking at like the rankings for these universities, they often, like, the most prominent ones often are in like the Western nations, like global north, like nations that are more developed. And for a lot of people, like getting into these universities does provide security, it provides opportunity that you wouldn't get if you were in like a university at a poorer country. And I feel like that is a lot of it's like modern day colonization, whether we realize it or not, because like if you were born and raised in the West, like you have access to these institutions much easier than if you were born in a country that was not, like if you didn't have as much money. It just takes so much more effort to get into these institutions to build a future for yourself. And another thing that's really interesting, like working in academics, is that for like a lot of researchers, like publications, to have like good publications, oftentimes those like publications are all like the journals are all Western journals, so also in the global north. And you actually have to pay a hefty sum to try to get published in those, apparently. And it's just interesting because if you're in the global south, you're competing with people who have more money and more opportunities in the global north. So I think there's just a lot of like modern day colonization happening just even within the academic institution, like as a system across the world, even if we don't realize it. And I feel like this novel kind of captures a bit of that, where Oxford hoards all of the resources. They have all the academic knowledge. And for these students of color, they have to go to Oxford if they wanted to succeed in the world.
Yeah. I also think that another way in which I see it in Canada specifically is the exploitation of international students. And that's specifically something that's been in the news more and more recently, because, yeah, which is completely reflected in Babel, because you have Victoire Rami and Robin, but also Anthony Griffin, a lot of these students and even professors who are people of color who are, like you said, they have to come into this institution to gain this knowledge, and then they're just exploited for its profit, which is exactly what universities in in Canada do. They charge absolutely outrageous tuition for international students, and then they restrict them so they can't work. They restrict the hours. There's so much restrictions for international students that come into Canada and how they can behave and what they can do. And so it leads to just a lot of extreme exploitation for these international students.
Yeah, and the level of gatekeeping too, because I think even if a lesser known university is doing really great work, just because their university is not well known, they're not going to get the same level of recognition as some of us in these better universities that are ranked and skewed based on Western standards.
Yeah, for sure. Malika, do you want to go ahead and share some of your thoughts?
I was just going to say about like Western education just in general. Growing up as like a child of immigrants, it's just so weird because like we viewed this like university was really hard for me, understanding that this wasn't like the dream, like learning about colonization. Like obviously we learned about colonization and imperialism in high school, but it was a very whitewashed, glorified version of those two concepts. And it's hard hitting when you come to uni and when you learn that, like, holy crap, being told, oh wow, your English is so good, or oh my god, you don't even have an accent, is bad. Like, or like not bad, but it's like it wasn't the compliment you thought it was growing up. Like I used to take it being like, oh, thank you, like all the time. Like, and I feel really guilty for doing that. It doesn't mean just because someone doesn't speak English or doesn't have a Canadian, American, British accent doesn't mean they're worth any less. But it's just weird how we've just been so ingrained into this Western ideology of what intelligence is all I wanted to say.
I think that's a fantastic point. And definitely going into the GRSJ program, all of this knowledge really, really hits you. I think it's so interesting because, Sunny, when you talk about academic institutions, I feel like when I was at UBC, there was two different universities. Obviously, there's like the overarching, but within it, you sort of have like these like faculty of arts programs, a lot of the more liberal arts programs. So people that, you know, are maybe taking, well, for sure taking GRSJ and then, but maybe taking sociology, psychology, and really studying more about like society, history, things like that. And then you have the side of like engineering and sciences that's kind of in a different space where they're not exposed to this education that, really like, you know, forces you to critically think about a lot of these institutions and systems, including the institution that you're at, the university, which is kind of a complex thing that your mind goes through during your degree if you're in one of those more social sciences programs. Okay, so I do want to kind of move on to that question. So obviously the focus of this novel is on languages, so their use and translation as a part of the British's mission of colonization. And so language is viewed quite differently by all of these characters. They kind of offer like a different view of language throughout the novel. But in the description of the book, it offers this line that I actually didn't read because I was scared of pronouncing these wrong because I didn't look them up. But it's two translations of the word. I believe it's to translate. So it's traductor. I'm not sure if that's right. And traditor. I think I'm pronouncing that wrong. But it's mostly the line. So it says, quote, an act of translation is always an act of betrayal. So obviously this does have like deeper meanings of like the lessons of betrayal in this novel. But I just kind of want to throw it out there to like get your kind of reaction to reading that quote, like if you think it's true, sort of how you think it kind of fits in this novel. So we'll start off with Sunny.
Maybe I have internalized violence, but I really like that quote a lot. I think it's, in some sense, it's kind of true. I'm going to talk about Chinese dramas because that's like, I understand the Chinese that is being spoken in Chinese dramas, and then I still watch it with subtitles because that's probably the easiest way to explain it. But I feel like there's two different ways that translation often happens. And like one is to keep it really true to the original form and when translation like that happens, you're often trying to like translate, like bring like say like Chinese culture to the English speaker. But then for the English speaker, there might be a little like difficult barrier of entry. So for example, a really common thing that happens in these Chinese dramas is in historical Chinese dramas, you don't ever call someone by their name. You usually call them by their title, and their title depends, their title changes depending on their relationship to you. So in a lot of these shows, like they'll have like three different names, but for like, so if you were to like stay true to the Chinese language, you would translate their different names in English, and that could be quite confusing for someone who grew up in North America to get like to feel like comfortable with, because we're so used to calling each other just by their first name. But then oftentimes in these translations, what they do is they translate it in English to just like one name, their like character's main name, so that even in the Chinese, like when they're talking to each other, they're using different names every time the translation shows up as the one name. And in some sense, that's kind of a betrayal, I think, to like the Chinese language and Chinese culture, because it erases the cultural dynamics in our relationships with each other and how our names shift. So I just feel like that's like a good like explanation, where I feel like it, like translating is a bit of this sense of betrayal, because you're trying to figure out the balance of like how much you keep the native language's culture in the translation, or how much you change it or cater it to who you're trying to like present this to.
Yeah, thank you. I feel like that's a fantastic example of how to sort of explain that quote and like the role of translation. Malika, I'm going to turn it over to you to get your thoughts on that line.
I think it was a beautiful line. It was really profound to me, because all these, like, I'm kind of repeating myself in the sense that it was just a really hard idea to grasp, because it's like you worked, like, speaking from personal experience, it's like we've worked so hard to achieve this like nuclear family household where it's like, oh, we don't like Hindi, that's not a thing, we only listen to or only speak it like with our grandparents, sort of thing. But then it's like our grandparents, like they're who have given us life, we respect our elders and everything, but we can't even afford, like in our house, like now as they're getting aging, I'm speaking more Hindi with my grandparents, but I used to refuse. I was kind of a little bit of a rude, rotten little child and being like, oh, well, we're in Canada, it's not like I have to speak Hindi to them. I don't, to one of my grandparents, I don't know Gujarati at all. Fiji Hindi like was foreign to me as well. So it's like, I wasn't even trying. It was like a betrayal to what they used to stand for. And it's always, they would say it to my face, like being like, oh, these kids, first they lose their language, then they're going to lose their culture, religion. So what? And it's at first I'm like, oh my God, you're exaggerating so much. Like, no, we're not going to lose all that. But you see it slowly happening. Like, I have been trying to teach myself Hindi, but it's not the same. It doesn't roll off the tongue. So it feels like a betrayal to people who fought so hard against like these systems of colonization. And then it's also that sense of like, oh my goodness, but like my grandparents are like so proud of the fact also though that I speak such perfect English. So then there's always that like dichotomous feeling of like pride, but then also like just very sad. So that line is just like, it just so beautiful to me, like it, and the sense where it's like, no matter what we do, it feels like a betrayal. Like I always explain it, like I feel like there's the white side of me and the brown side of me. And with translation, you're betraying either or, like trying to say something in Hindi, that's say a Hindi word in English. Like it's just really like you're losing so much of what it actually means, or like you're taking so many words to explain something that's done in one concept. Or like one like word, like you're taking like six sentences to try to explain. So yeah, that's kind of how I feel about the quote.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing. I think it's like what you're saying about how like there's always like something lost or something betrayal. It makes me think like in the novel also, I think to me, I sort of read this quote because I grew up speaking English is my family's historical native language. I don't, like, you know, my family comes from England, so I don't have that necessary relation. But the one way that I thought about it is actually from the view of English and the betrayal of, I think, how English betrays this idea of, like, this kind of utopian idea of translation, because it is part of a colonial project to overtake, you know, languages and cultures around the world. And so this sort of way that it's treated as an innocent in the relationship with other languages, but it actually tends to be the aggressor and to overpower. So that brings me to a quote that I really want to share from the book. This comes from the moment when I believe it's actually the exact moment of when Robin is about to die or is dying. And he's talking about Adamic languages. I'm not sure how to pronounce that word, but basically, like, one universally understood language for the world. And so he says, quote, "For how could there ever be an endemic language? The thought now made him laugh. There was no innate, perfectly comprehensible language. There was no candidate, not English, not French, that could bully and absorb enough to become one. Language was just difference, a thousand different ways of seeing, of moving through the world. No, a thousand worlds within one. And translation, a necessary endeavor, however futile, to move between them." End quote. So I think that's kind of interesting, because it does, I don't think it's a counter to the quote of that, like, with every act of translation, there's an act of betrayal, because it does sort of recognize that there is, because he says that it's sort of a futile endeavor, because it's never actually going to be perfect. But I think that quote kind of summarizes this, like, overall very complex view of language in the novel. So I do really want to get to one more question before we get to the end of this episode. So I want to talk about violence, because this book obviously touches a lot on violence and its role and how it's viewed in the novel, and also, like, in the world of Babel of this novel. And so we have the violence of white British colonization, but then we have discussions of the use of violence by the Hermes Society in their fight against the British. So this is related to academia, which Sunny's already, like, mentioned quite a bit. But Babel is an academic institution. So the question that the author and the novel kind of gives to us in, well, actually, in quote, is, quote, "Can powerful institutions be changed from within, or does revolution always require violence?" End quote. Obviously, this is, like, a very broad, complex question that the novel sort of seeks to explore throughout. But I am curious to hear your thoughts on that question, and is sort of, like, a view of the whole novel overall, because it does relate to the ending. So, Sunny, do you want to start us off?
Sure. I think my thought behind this is going to be very much colored by the fact that I currently work at the university as staff. So it's been really interesting transitioning from being a student to staff end. And I would like to be optimistic and say it doesn't require violence, but I also have contradictory opinion, where I feel like there is no such thing as decolonization within an existing colonial system. Like, to decolonize means to overturn the entire thing. And the longer I've worked in academia, the more I feel like the existing system very much upholds existing power systems. And it's just, I can't really think of a way to, like, how you could work within that system to decolonize. I feel like it would require an overhaul of a lot of things, a lot of structures. That's my very abstract thought behind it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing. And it definitely, it is a very different view to be, like, sort of a student at the institution versus working in it. It's a very different outlook. It's a very different position to be in. And I think also, as someone who's working there, it's very different depending on where you are positioned. Like, it's different to be the president versus a non-tenured, you know, poorly paid professor.
Yeah, I feel like for most people who work at the university, you realize that it's quite entrenched. Like, there's not much that I as an individual could do to make life better for students or to just overturn anything. I imagine it might be a bit different at the top, but I also feel like academic institutions are so governed by capitalism that I'm not sure what it would be like at the top, but I imagine the finances do a lot of the talking.
Yeah, well, I think it, again, drawing from the book, like when they talk about how Babbel just does whatever is best for itself to make money, it will help whoever it needs to make the money to keep itself going. Malika, do you want to go ahead and share your thoughts?
Yeah, I was just going to say, sorry, I wanted you guys to finish your thoughts because I feel like I've been cutting everyone off. I'm sorry. I apologize about that.
You're doing great. I love hearing your thoughts.
Please don't ever apologize. Interrupt whenever you feel like it.
Thank you. I had a professor once who said that in the university is inherently arbiters of colonial and capitalistic power. So as the role of, like, they were using themselves as the example, being like, I myself, like, if we were to look at colonialism as a religion, I would technically be an archbishop being a tenured professor, considering how much the university itself holds up these colonial standards. And I just thought that was very profound, and I thought about that a lot while I was reading Babbel, because I'm someone who does want to go into academia. I've been applying to grad school, like I'm starting to actually send them out, my applications and stuff. And it's just a really, like, you're trying to grapple with it. Like, I remember when I first graduated, I was like, holy, oh my goodness, I am more entrenched in colonialism than any of colonialism and capitalism than any, like, I debate a lot with my cousins, and they're always like, oh, but we need capitalism, we need, it was good, like, colonialism was good, like, stuff like that. And I'm always fighting, like, no, like, what do you mean it's not good? Like, obviously it's not good, things like that. And, like, we're always pushing back and forth. And then just having that realization that, oh my gosh, I'm more entrenched in this colonial institution that upholds that upholds just straight up colonialism than my, like, silly cousins that actually believe in these, like, ideals. Like, that was, like, a really hard and bitter pill to swallow. And I don't know, it was just like, it's just so interesting. It's like, I feel like I can do a lot of work within research and academia to maybe, like, understand how colonialism affects these things, but I don't think within the system I could potentially, like, change it. Like, it's just been so entrenched into society, and, like, the violence aspect of it is, you can't have colonialism without violence. Like, it's just, they just go straight up hand in hand, whether it's gentrification or, like in Babbel, colonizing languages to make to profit off of it. And that's where it all goes down to. Everything's done for profit. And when, I don't know, it's just, it really makes you think about how you want to do your work. Like, within academia, you could try. I would say, like, we have so many amazing feminist scholars that were really would examine and critique these systems of capitalism and would bring it forward, like, try to create change and bring it forward. But then at the same time, we're still stagnated as it is a pillar of colonialism. So there's just so many ideas that run through my head. And I just find it so interesting how Kwong puts this, like, ideology throughout the novel from, like, beginning to end, of, like, Robin and his feelings of complicity, joining the Hermes Society, like, all of it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, like, a huge question, because I know for me, I, you know, going to GRSHA program is filled with all of this, like, you know, decolonial thought, like, anti-racism thought, anti-colonial thought. And then, you know, you graduate and you're forced to kind of go back into the larger academia institution or out into the other parts of the world that do exist outside of the academy that replicate a lot of those power institutions and colonization. So, like, I'm super interested in working for the government, which is, again, a colonial institution. And the conversation of, like, how much can you change through, like, being a politician or working in public service when the institution itself is extremely flawed. I do just want to, again, end on a quote. I am a quotes person, and this book has so many, I think, good quotes that explore ideas presented in this novel. So Robin has this quote quote, "That is how colonialism works. It convinces us that the fallout from resistance is entirely our fault, that the immoral choice of resistance is resistance itself rather than the circumstances that demand it," end quote. And yeah, I think that kind of gives like the broader view of like the role of violence in colonialism. And I think it also speaks to a lot of what we see happening today, as far as movements goes, and society's reaction to these movements and fighting for human rights and justice, as being inherently violent when it's sort of this system and institution forces this act of violence to maintain any basis of humanity. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. I'm so glad I split this into two, but I almost feel like we could have done four episodes. But thank you so much for being here. And I will offer you, if either of you have any final thoughts that you want to offer before we conclude tonight's episode.
Thank you for having us, Randy. I don't think I have anything else to add. I'll save my thoughts for the next episode. But thank you so much for having me on here. And Malika, it's so great to chat with you again.
Yeah, thank you, Randy, for inviting me on and inviting me to the opportunity to hear you and Sunny both talk about this book that I really grasped onto it and loved it as someone who's been studying colonialism within GRSJ and as someone who, like, language was always a big like deal for me, being like, oh yeah, like for going from bragging about only knowing English to it being a shameful thing. So it's just really interesting being able to talk with you, and I love Sunny's opinion or a point of views of the book, like seeing them as chess pieces, like that was just so like brilliant to me, like the characters. I was like, it's literally just been ingrained in my mind. I'm like, wow, like how did I not see this in my second read? I'm like, wow.
But I just, like, sorry, I'm just jumping back. And I feel like, I don't know about you, but I feel like I'm a chess piece in colonization and capitalism and Western society in some sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very true. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's a very great reflection, Sunny. Okay. Well, thank you both so much for coming on the show. I look forward to our next episode. But listeners, that brings us to the end of this episode. So once again, you can find me, Randy, the host, on Instagram at Dog Ear Radio Book Club. And you can find Sunny on Instagram at Van Reads. Please go check out her page. I have so many books on my TBR that have been recommended to me on Instagram by Sunny that I'm so excited to get to. And yeah, if you haven't picked up Babel yet, please go pick it up. Please read it. Even though we spoiled all of it, I promise it'll still be really good. And make sure you stay tuned for our next episode.